It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hey guys, Rick here from the Mobile Hunter Podcast, and I'm here to tell you about one of our sponsors, Saddy's LLC, Custom Ammunition and Gun Works. Aaron Satterfield and his family have been turning out some awesome game loads that have been putting down deer, waterfowl, and turkey all year long. The Saddy's Fatty, the turkey load that we use, can stop a bird dead in its tracks. Check them out at SaddiesLLC.com. That's SattiesLLC.com or on Facebook at Saddy's LLC and tell them the Mobile Hunter Podcast sent you.
Welcome to the Mobile Hunter Podcast. Our mission is simple. We want to help you become a better hunter. We believe that mobility kills and efficiency will set you free.
Welcome to the Mobile Hunter Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Cates, and I'm joined tonight by my other two hosts, Chris Leppert and Josh Luck. Guys, how's it going tonight?
What up?
How's it going?
And tonight, we have the pleasure of being joined by Mr. Stuart Keene of the Hunting Ground. Stuart, how's it going?
It's going good. I'm glad it's springtime.
Me too, which I'm glad you're here because we get to talk. We get to continue this wonderful theme that we've been going on that we've had quite a few people complain about, but they can complain all they want. We're going to keep talking about turkeys until the start of May. It's amazing to see as many people say that they want their deer hunting stuff back when it is so painfully obvious that there's nothing better than a screaming turkey in the woods this time of year.
Oh, yeah, I can't disagree with that.
Amen.
So Stuart, for our listeners, if you would, could you give us a little bit about your background, where you're located at, and just some of your, you know, basic experience getting into the woods and hunting birds?
Yeah, so I'm from North Georgia, about an hour and a half, 2 hours north of Atlanta, so Southern Appalachian Mountains. And growing up, all we did was deer hunt and squirrel hunt. So my dad wasn't a turkey hunter. And I was always infatuated with them and I knew that I eventually wanted to hunt them. And like I said, my dad never went. So whenever I was old enough to hunt by myself in Georgia, that was the age of 12. You could go take a class and get your certification to legally hunt unsupervised. So that spring, I think it was 2013 or 2012, I kind of just got the basics. Didn't have a turkey vest. I still don't use one to this day. I think I started out with a slate call that someone gave me and a H&R partner break open shotgun with, I think it was pheasant loads. I didn't even have a proper turkey load at the time. So basically self-taught, even more than deer hunting, because obviously I grew up doing that. So I didn't have a mentor. I just had YouTube back then, which there wasn't much, just like the old Primo's videos that they would upload. So the first couple springs was a real challenge, but the first time I heard one gobble in the woods was unreal. You know, I still remember that time, but it took me a couple springs until I actually got my first bird. And then it's just all been downhill since then. So that's been probably, I guess, 11 or 12 years ago now, and just enjoyed it every spring since then. So I really love hunting them in the mountains, just like I do with deer. But in the past couple of years, I've started traveling just a little bit, and it's becoming even more addictive. So I'm glad that it's springtime. I'll say that.
Awesome. So with traveling to go after birds, just easterns, or do you have any other ones under your belt?
So right now, up until 2 years ago, it was just easterns. The first out-of-state bird I got was in Alabama, in northern Alabama, which was challenging. But then the following year, I tried the whole Florida thing, and I don't think anything could have prepared me for that, but I did a little research down there. And that was quite the experience, because I ended up getting one on the first morning. And it's kind of an unbelievable story, just because the people that were down there could hardly believe that I got one. But I attribute most of that to luck. But Miriam's was on the list last year. It's still on the list this year. I never made that trip, but I really, really want to go hunt up in the Northwest. So right now it's been easterns. And then I got my first Osceola 2 springs ago. So that's the extent of it so far.
That's awesome, dude. So before we kind of dive in a little bit, you talked about not using a vest. What do you use? Do you run a pack or?
So when I first started, even back then, I was carrying a camera, but it was very basic. It was such a cheap camera, it really didn't work that well. And I would just carry the tripod back then, but I didn't use anything, a pack or really anything to carry, just my pockets and then carrying my gun and my tripod. But as I started filming more, like for the hunting grounds, and needed something a bit more stable and a larger camera, I started carrying a backpack. You'll learn that I'm pretty much as basic as it comes. It's just a Walmart backpack that I started with, but I use that just for my camera and maybe throwing water in or something. But as far as my calls, everything goes in my pockets, which back then when I started was basically nothing. But now I carry a couple more things. I always have a crow call, one or two mouth calls, and then a slate call for reaching out farther when I need to or on windy days. So as far as gear goes, I don't have much more now than I did when I started. So I keep it pretty simple. Yeah, just a backpack even to this day. So,
okay. And tell us a little bit about your gun setup.
So when I started out, obviously I used that single shot H&R, and now that I've started using TSS, it's a lot different even than back then. Not necessarily for far shots, but just having the ability if you need to shoot through a little bit of brush with that heavier load. So for the past 8 years, I've been using Mossberg 835 pump. It's chambered in 3.5, and I shot lead in that for the first few years, and then 3 years ago I switched to tungsten, and I really loved that. So it definitely it took away a lot of struggles, and maybe it could have been fixed with a little bit more patterning and tweaking on the setup when I shot the lead. But I used to lose a lot of birds right around that 35-40 yard mark. And a lot of the shots are on video, and I just didn't know what happened. And looking back, it was probably, even for my setup, a little bit too far, because it would look like they didn't even get shot at. It was like I was shooting blanks. And
what were you using?
At the time, I was using Winchester Longbeard XR right around the time those came out.
Really?
Yep. And I have those on video. I've got, I think, 3 or 4 occasions, 3 for sure on video. And I also had some misfires with those loads. And I don't know, I did a little bit of research in that. And I think part of it was because I bought them from Walmart, because I swear there was a difference between them, between buying them from a gun shop. They were a little bit cheaper at Walmart. But anyways, since I switched to TSS, I've not had a single one of those instances. And that's not even taking far shots. You know, I'm just saying, go right about that 40 mark. So I've been very happy with my setup since then. And it's still okay. The same old, but just switching to tungsten, everyone these days knows the weight difference there. It's just astronomical, you know, so I'll obviously never go back to shooting lead.
It is crazy. I rolled a bird at about between 35 and 40. And I like pushed my buddy over. I was celebrating in the blind. We got up to go pick up the bird and it was gone. And I walked 50 yards over the hill and it flew away. And that was with a long beard. I could not believe it. And it wasn't for a while, you know, till I discovered TSS. And of course, as you said, you know, once you figure out why TSS is good, I mean, don't get me wrong, it's expensive, but it's
worth it.
I mean, you're talking about, I mean, how much do you pay per arrow? What's on an arrow these days?
Right. Yeah.
$40, you know? So, and people complain about a, you know, $6 to $10 shell. And it's like, well, if you shoot the bird and it dies, then it's damn well worth it. I mean, I know it's, you know, really expensive when we're talking about ammo, but it's pretty nice and forgiving. What shot size you run in, choke, all that?
Yeah, so the choke is just the same choke that's been in there for 8 years now. It's a Mojo choke. I'm not sure what the restriction is on that. And then the shells that I'm running, I ran the first year I shot Federals. I think that was a blend of 7 and 9s.
Okay.
And 2 years ago, I started buying the Apexes. I didn't see much of a difference between those, but I liked both of those. They both knock birds down. I didn't shoot either of them at paper, but I've not lost a turkey since I started shooting those. Not that I couldn't, obviously you could still miss, but as far as those wide open 40 yard shots, it's like night and day, even watching it on video. You can just tell a difference in the shot hitting the bird. So, I think
you're running
still
a 12 gauge.
Yes. 12 gauge. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. And that's, a blend of 7 and 9.
You still running a 3.5 in that?
The first year, the Federals were 3.5, and then now the Apexes that I shoot are 3-inch.
Okay.
Awesome. Yeah,
pretty good.
Well, let's go ahead, Rick.
I just say I can't even imagine a 3.5-inch TSS shell coming out of a 12-gauge. It's like
that's
a proud
that paper.
I mean, they make fun of me because I still use a 12. And I think the Saddies that I use are they 2 3/4? I think they're 2 3/4.
Yeah.
I remember the first one that I shot that was a 3. That was still kicking pretty hard. It's nothing like the old nitro turkeys or anything like that where you feel like you're going to dislodge your shoulder. Mm-hmm. But you know, there's something to be said about TSS out of a 12 gauge. It's like you hit a bird, it ain't moving.
Yeah, right. I always crack up when Aaron's like, yeah, I got an order for 3.5 and like 9s or something. And I'm like, good Lord. Like, because he can fit, what is it, Chris? He can essentially get like a 2, is it a 2 3/4 or a 3-inch out of a 12? And it's essentially the same as shooting like a 3.5.
So basically what he did is he took a 3-inch shell and put it in a 2 3/4-inch shell.
Yeah.
Now, what's also interesting is the same 1 5/8 ounce loads that we were shooting out of a 12 gauge, we shoot out of a 20 gauge with very similar results. In fact, talking with Aaron the other night when me and Seth and everybody were over there, and then talking with Josh in our last episode, it's actually like, I'm not trying to down people that shoot like a 12 gauge or whatever, or even a 16, but essentially like when you look at what you're getting out of a 12 versus a 20, the, what you're getting in your pattern doesn't really add up as far as like what you're taking in weight of the gun, recoil, etc. If that makes sense. It was very interesting to hear that. And in fact, Fox said that a 7/8 ounce load in a 410 would like compare to a lead 12 gauge. Like, I forget exactly what size. I don't know if it was 1 5/8 or 2 ounce, but that's just psycho to even think about that a 410 could do that. I knew a 20 could, but it's that's significantly more than a 410. So kind of neat.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
He claims that a lot of people put fillers in the 3-inch shells.
Really?
What were you going to say, Stu?
I was just going to say it's come a long way, and I'm not really educated on, you know, the fine tuning of the setups that a lot of these guys do. It's impressive, you know, the amount of work and science that people put into it. But at the end of the day, unless you're really trying to snipe a turkey, I mean, for your average, you know, 40, 50, 60 and under shot, you know, I don't feel like you have to dive that deep into it, you know,
yeah,
put a setup to kill one. You know, I think people overthink it a lot with every aspect of it, but
yeah,
it's really cool to see what these guys can do to put the numbers together and develop these amazing, you know, hunting shotguns.
Mm-hmm. It's crazy. So tell us a little bit about covering some ground to find some birds. I got to hunt with you in the eastern United States, we'll call it. We went on a little hunt together, and you know, talking to Emery, he talked about how you weren't afraid to walk. And then when we went in to help you pack that buck out, you know, I did my fair share of walking, and I didn't really expect that. I don't expect that from most people. So when we were walking, when I was walking to come meet you guys, I'm like, damn, man, am I there yet? Are we there yet, Mom? So tell us a little bit why you believe covering ground helps you in the turkey woods.
Well, I would say one of the main factors is if you were hunting an area that you're unfamiliar with, or even before hunting, just scouting, it's a big factor, because when you're dealing with large expanses of land that on a map all look the same, which in the Appalachian Mountains, you're dealing with that a lot. And not that I don't even use maps that much for turkeys, because there's, well, let me back up. I do use maps a lot, but a lot of it is just finding areas close to private land that I can access. There's obviously opportunity for more of a backwoods style hunt, but those, it's kind of a risk versus reward situation with how far you want to walk and then come back in there the next day, say if you scout and find them. So stumbling upon them is one thing, but trying to find, you know, like a deer in the middle of nowhere, I don't do that as much with turkeys, even though it can be done. But I think covering ground is very important, not just with scouting, but like I said, hunting an unfamiliar area. I know a lot of times these days, like when guys go out of state, they've already talked to someone. You know, half those guys out there have a pin dropped to them, even if they don't tell you that. You know,
amen to that. There are a lot of those. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, if what you see on Instagram half the time, I'm going to say at least half is someone didn't just drive there from another state and get lucky the next morning.
Amen.
But I'm hating on that, but it may not be the best thing for the turkey population. But I mentioned to y'all, not that it's a super important factor and most people probably wouldn't do it, but I do like to wear baseball cleats, mainly just because of the terrain. And you can be even quieter than deer hunting, just because there's not as much leaf litter on the ground and it can be softer in the spring. So having those rubber spikes that sink in versus the boots that's slipping, I think is big. Whether you're getting in tight to one on the roost or just trying to, you know, press closer to one without making a crazy amount of noise. But as far as covering ground goes, it's a little bit self-explanatory in a sense that if you're willing to go the extra mile to either find a bird or to get to one that's gobbling, you're either A, going to beat the other guy there if he's gobbling on the roost, or B, if you're scouting, you're going to find birds that say other people haven't found or don't hunt that much. And nothing's better than an unpressured turkey.
Man.
So
delicious.
Being able to cover ground's huge, because if something goes wrong on the first setup and you have to completely abandon for whatever reason, not being completely worn out by the time you get to the second bird would be a huge advantage.
Okay. I like this baseball cleat idea, by the way. It kind of reminds me a little bit of using trekking poles, where you're just, I feel like it's gonna, obviously it's not like wearing a nice lace-up boot or anything to support, you know, your ankles and stuff like that would, but it seems like you'd be able to grip the ground going across hills and stuff like that, and just be able to kind of, well, like you said, cover more ground with maybe a little less effort.
Are you using a baseball, a physical actual baseball cleat, or are you using a turf shoe?
It's an actual baseball cleat, but it's not okay. the metal type. And I still haven't found one that I absolutely love, which obviously they're not made for that. but I use the molded rubber style, so they're a bit more forgiving. Mm-hmm. And you can find some with a bit more ankle support, but there's a obvious, the main thing honestly is stamina and not getting tired with the flopping rubber boot or even an ankle. And then in terrain, whether you're trying to get up on the same elevation as one quickly that's roosted, or just trying to be quiet when you're slipping to a closer proximity on one that you're already working, because I feel like a lot of people kind of hope for a miracle whenever they're working a bird that's say 300 yards away, and they really should be, instead of calling at all, should be going ahead and closing that to 150 or even 75 yards if you're using the terrain, and then that bird's not just over there strutting and you're wasting your time. You can make him through that hen that's come that close to him, and then that's where I would switch to maybe disguising my feet noise as scratching and then purring. And then once you're in that bubble, you know, a lot of times it's game over if you play your cards right from there on in and if he's in the right mood. So all that comes down to being able to cover ground, which is what you asked about.
Love it. It's go ahead, Josh.
I was just going to say, just off that point that Seward just brought up about getting in that bubble, it kind of reminds me of, like, we talk about bed hunting. Not saying we're bed hunting birds, but like when you get close to a buck's bed, right, you kind of have to in order to get them in daylight, right? There's a certain, I refer to it as a safe zone. And I've talked to Chris about this multiple times. Like, you kind of have to figure out their safe zone. And once you're in there, like, the odds of you, getting a chance at that buck in daylight just increase. Kind of like what you were talking about with the bird, and you get in their safe zone. And even if, you know, according to nature, right, the tom is supposed to gobble and call and the hen's supposed to come to him. Well, if you got a little bit of terrain there, right, where it's kind of covering you, covering his vision, but you're in that safe zone, like you said, that 75 yards or so, where he's like, she's just over that knoll. I'll just hop right on over there. In my mind, that's how I kind of think of that scenario, right? You get to a position, like you said, you can just, you know, scratch the leaves a little bit, cluck softly, and then, you know, they'll work their way over. That's what I did on private in Ohio last year. I was contained by the property line. I had two toms over on the neighbors in this little kind of meadow, strutting and gobbling multiple times, and I just stayed back on our property. I don't know, I was probably 80 yards or so, 75, right in that kind of bubble. And I couldn't move. I was probably 40 yards off the line. I had to wait for them to cross, but I just scratched a little bit, made some light calling, right? And it took them a while, but they eventually worked their way on over. So it does work out in your favor if you can find the right scenario.
It's always interesting hearing other turkey people talk. I went years without meeting any before this whole Facebook thing and everything kind of blew up, you know, the social media or whatever, and all of us somehow ending up meeting each other. And there's one thing in common with every single one that I come in contact with. As soon as they get close to a bird, a lot of times the calling is significantly softer and they're scratching in the leaves, which really it comes down to the leaves scratching. And I still think that there's so many people that don't realize what scratching in the leaves for 45 seconds to a minute will do, because that can sound more realistic than a lot of people's calling, honestly. And it's something, again, that a lot of people somehow still don't do. So, you know, it's interesting.
I think it boils down to, like, you know, for the longest time, you know, everybody, I mean, you either had a box call. I mean, like, you know, I look at people like my dad, where it's like they reintroduced turkeys in the 70s and you're just hitting a box call and you have no idea about turkey behavior because nobody knew what the hell to do about them. And then finally, I don't think enough people pay attention to turkey behavior when you got them sitting in front of you, because they're so focused in on a gobbler versus focusing in on a pack of hens. I mean, when we hunt that farm in Kentucky, that's got all the hens on it. Like you could sit there and you can listen to them and listen to all the different noises that they make and just sit there and watch them. You guys watch those hens for what, 2 hours one day?
Yeah.
And you sit there and you watch just their general behavior, and people don't pay attention to that because you become so hyper focused on like, I need to call in order to get a gobble. Like it's like yeah. trying to throw quarters in a slot machine. It's like, I'm going to hit the jackpot here eventually, when really there's like a stack of $100 bills sitting right in front of you that you could be taking.
Yeah. And, mm-hmm. and to the point, Rick, that reminds me of a hunt I had 3 springs ago, and it was the second to last day of the Georgia turkey season. I had one tag left, and I went into an area before work that I could access by road, but it was a spot that the backside of the property bordered the lake. And I had used my boat to come in before, but in this particular spot, I could park and walk less than 400 yards and be to where I needed to be. And I had heard a bird in there before I had went on a family vacation the week before. And so I had one day left, and I went in there before work, and I didn't hear anything, you know, right off the rip. But after a few minutes, I heard one gobble out on a peninsula. So there's nothing but lake behind it. And then there's about a 80 to 90 yard stretch at the bottleneck. And that's where I sat down once I heard him gobble out on that point. And it had been burned probably 2 months beforehand, maybe 3 months beforehand. So there's not a lot of, there's no leaves to scratch. It's fairly open except for the fact that it's late season. So where there is foliage, it's grown in, and there were some briar thickets behind me. But to the point of overcalling and calling close once they get in range, the bird was gobbling on the roost, went fairly silent. And in the meantime, probably about 15 minutes after what I thought would be fly down time, I see a body walking my direction from the peninsula, and it turns out to be a hen. So she started yelping once she got in my proximity, because I had called a little bit to him when he was on the roost. And she spent the next, I think it was 9 or 10 minutes, because it was all on video, yelping periodically. Not quite assembly calls, but pretty aggressive, loud yelps. Like you would probably be telling your buddy to shut up if he was running a box call while the bird's out on the peninsula. And she's just there yapping in front of me, you know, and the bird didn't gobble much at all to her. So there's a natural scenario where you might be slapping your buddy for overcalling. I'm just sitting there watching it. The bird's gone silent at this point. She moves off behind me, thankfully. So I'm in between her and the bird. And it took him another 10 minutes before I even saw his body come into view from that peninsula, in and out of three-quarter strut, no gobbles. She's moved off. She's just spent the last 5 or 6 minutes yelping up, you know, at this little bottleneck. And I didn't yelp again after that. I did just soft, you know, bubble clucks and purrs, and I killed him right at 30 yards. And he didn't gobble once he hit the ground. So I wouldn't advocate, and I wouldn't ever yelp like that hen did, but it didn't spook the bird off. Obviously, it's a natural scenario. And once again, that's late season, but that's just something that came to mind comparing the two scenarios, that there's not yep. one solution.
That's so neat to hear. It's amazing. You know, you talked about nothing's better than an unpressured bird. Those things get ran around a little bit. And I mean, they're stupid, right? Like technically, cognitively, they're not supposed to be able to put much together in their head. But whatever the hell the reason, they shut up, man. Yeah. It's crazy. And, you know, hearing you, and then, I mean, I've had late season hunts with our buddy Pierce, who, you know, he'll never admit to being a good caller, but he's a really good caller and has a lot of good woodsmanship, like you were talking about and everything. And just a great understanding for wild turkeys. And I mean, just watching him be so patient and climb a ladder with a bird to get him to do what he wanted is just insane. But I also think, I still think there was probably a scenario there where we had birds that were willing to play, because we had 2 or 3 other ones that were roosted that I accidentally made gobble, and that you could tell they were trying to be tight-lipped, and I just screamed a hoot call. Like, I didn't try to sound realistic. I just tried to be as loud as I could, and it was like, he was like, oh, like it just slipped out, like, oh damn, I said something, he's on me. So and they gobbled one time and that was it. We never heard him gobble after fly down. We never made him gobble again, nothing. So but the other birds, you'd have thought it was opening day, you know, once he got them ramped up. So it's crazy how that can happen, though. And this is last couple days of the season, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think people tend to forget that there are so many variables, but because so many turkey hunts are the same, you know, whether it's ones you watch on YouTube or ones you experience yourself, once you're at that point of success, the traditional turkey hunt is kind of what's known. But there's a couple of different flocks I've hunted, one on public and then one on a friend's piece of private. And those birds were some of the strangest I've ever hunted. And it was because of the, in my opinion, the coyote population in both of those areas. They would do odd things, very limited calling. In the evening, we tried hunting them like a roost hunt in the evening. They would come in and fly up an hour before fly up and look around. Super cautious. They wouldn't gobble much. And in fact, on the private piece, one of the times my buddy hunted there without me, he tried doing the roost hunt scenario, tried calling, and they had a coyote, actually a black coyote, stalk up right behind them on that property, coming to the turkey calling. So it's like they get conditioned over the years in these areas with certain predator populations, and they know that if they sit there and gobble or whatever, you might have some funky turkeys that take some untraditional tactics to take down, and you shouldn't just always be in that frame of mind where it's going to be a yelp him up situation. So
yeah. Mm-hmm. That sounds like a damn Idaho elk hunt with all the wolves, man. They ain't saying shit.
We've run into odd scenarios like that. I mean, I was very green at the time. What was this when we all hunted together in Kentucky? 2019, 2020?
2021. Yeah.
Yep. Oh, wow.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're going to talk about. 2021.
So it was a real, I mean, this piece was heavy pressure. I would call it heavy pressure during turkey season. Like, people everywhere. By the second day, those birds, like, you normally think, like, oh, the bird's going to come up top to these open fields, strut, do their thing. After that second day, or after the first day, after, because all the pressure was in the fields, those birds would not come up to those fields. They would stay down on the benches, down in the bottoms, right? And it was wild, because it was one of the hunts was Chris, our buddy Luke, and I, and we were actually there, I don't know, an hour and a half before daylight. Chris, we were there a while before.
Crazy.
And we were just sitting there kind of waiting for daylight, we went to a spot, just standing there waiting to kind of hear a gobble and then go set up on a bird. But we had a group of four people, or maybe it was six, I can't remember. It was quite a few. They came, walk right past us, maybe like a half hour till first light. And then they split and go. There's a field split, and there's two different kind of sections of this field. And one went to the one in front of us, and one went just down below us. Like, the one people had to set up within 100 yards of us, 100, 150 maybe. And we were like, well, son of a gun. So anyway, so daylight's coming. The bird starts firing up. We kind of set up where we were standing, just a little bit down below. And those other people started calling. Well, that bird pitched down. It didn't go up top. It pitched down into this bottom, this creek bottom. And we could hear it working its way off in the bottom. And we're like, oh, like, well, let's get up and go back towards. We ended up going back towards the parking lot. And basically what we were doing, we were covering the saddles on where that bird could potentially come out of the bottom. And it didn't come out of the first one. We heard it looping its way around. We went all the way back towards the cars and watch this turkey come up out of a creek bottom, trying to hit the saddle and stay and cover as much as he could. It was wild. We were deer hunting birds.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey guys, Rick here from the Mobile Hunter Podcast, and I'm here to tell you about one of our sponsors, Saddy's LLC, Custom Ammunition and Gun Works. Aaron Satterfield and his family have been turning out some awesome game loads that have been putting down deer, waterfowl, and turkey all year long. The Saddy's Fatty, the turkey load that we use, can stop a bird dead in its tracks. Check them out at SaddiesLLC.com. That's SattiesLLC.com. Or on Facebook at Saddies LLC and tell them the Mobile Hunter Podcast sent you.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah, that's just something where he's learned to deal with the pressure, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Which reminds me of another unique scenario. Probably 6 or 7 years ago, I hadn't been turkey hunting, but maybe 4 or 5 years. And there was this group of turkeys on public that I hunted. I only hunted them for 2 springs, and the access was kind of weird, so I didn't hunt them that often. But I would always try them, and they would gobble on the roost and then completely disappear. I couldn't find any scratching or any sign around where they were at. I could never figure out where they were going, and I eventually gave up on them. I don't know if I ever even laid eyes on them. And then 3 or 4 years ago, I hunted this group of turkeys that's near a family member's land, but it's on public, and they're kind of hit or miss on if they're there. 1 year or the next, but they would come down to a field on private, and I knew they had to be roosting on public, and come to find out they were roosting 300 to 400 yards up this ridge in thick mature white pines, and I didn't know it until I actually hunted them and heard them soaring over my head. They were gobbling and roosting way up on this ridge, flying off and soaring all the way down to this field, you know, without landing in the woods. Like a 300 to 500 yard stretch all the way down. So then I was like, it hit me back when I used to hunt those old birds. That's exactly what they were doing. They were staying up there and then completely disappearing. Who knows how far they were flying all the way back down to where they spent their time at during the day. So it's kind of an interesting thing to connect the dots and realize that that's something that they will do.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, they definitely adapt. Their survival instincts kicked in, and they adapt to the predators they're exposed to. It kills me online. We'll talk about the tactics we use, like last year trying to hunt some birds, and people are like, "Well, that's not bird hunting. You're deer hunting those turkeys." I'm like, "Well, we walked out of the woods with birds.
Like, I'm out there to kill a bird. I'm not out there to sit there and like figure it all out to not have something. If deer hunting for a bird is going to work, it's going to work."
Yeah.
And it's so funny. Bird hunters, turkey, waterfowl, they're the worst. I mean, they're so judgmental. It's crazy. I love turkey hunting, but there's so many turkey hunters that are like, "Oh, well, that ain't turkey hunting." It's like, "Well, I'm not out here for you, man." And listen, I get that there are certain things that we're trying to avoid to maybe help populations rebound a little better. But at the end of the day, if I was out there to watch the sun come up, I'd go hiking. Like, I'm here to kill a turkey. And whether I let him strut in to 15 yards or 60 or whatever that may be, you know, they're not every turkey hunt's the same, and it's not TV turkeys, you know, in states with a bunch of birds where you got opportunities tend to get a little easier when you got a bunch of gobbles and everything. And then if you're a guy, we love you, Stuart, I'm not poking fun at you here, but if you're a guy that's single or has no kids or something, you don't have kids, right?
Not kids, but I am married.
Yeah, I knew you were married. But, you know, if you don't have kids, you have absolutely zero idea what it's like to try to hunt when you have kids and the wife that wants you to feel like the worst human being on the face of the planet when you go hunting with kids. So you just, you know, and mine is like, I don't even know what I'd call her, seasoned, maybe. Like, I got her where I want her finally, but we went through those stages when we first had Cora and so on, where like that's a struggle. So you can't just go hunting whenever you want and say, oh, well, yeah, you know what? I don't want to kill that turkey past 30 yards, man. You win today, buddy. Like, you'd never kill it. You'd never kill a bird if you did that. So every turkey hunt's different, and people do need to understand that. People get a little too judgy.
Yeah, and I prefer the traditional turkey hunt, but I can only imagine what it's like for new turkey hunters with the way social media is today. You know, everyone looks the same these days. They've all got the exact same, you know, camo and brand of cigar probably that they smoke when they're done. I don't know. I don't buy into all that. I don't know. I won't get into all that. But yeah, I prefer a traditional turkey hunt, but sometimes you have to, I'm not talking about shooting them off the roost, but sometimes you got to change your mindset for a tougher bird.
Yeah. Spotlight them a little bit. No. It is interesting because if you joke about, I mean, let's just come out with it. If you joke about poaching a deer, you'll get death threats. But if you joke about hopping a fence, everyone laughs. The damn game warden laughs. Like, it's just, I don't know what it is, man. Can't stop the hop. It's freaking hilarious. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I wasn't saying anything.
Okay. But no, I do think, you know, I would agree with you too. Like, I think everybody prefers the traditional turkey hunt. But, I mean, they just don't all do what you want. So if you want to go home with one, right, you gotta change it up, maybe shoot a little further, or maybe, you know, get in there early on him before daylight, closer to the roost. Whatever, water access. I mean, there's like a million different ways to skin a cat, kill him coming to the roost. Nobody ever talks about that. If you have turkeys that are coming consistently to a roost, that's like going to be money.
I mean, realistically though, that hasn't been the case in most places, at least north of Kentucky, for the past 10 to 12 years. Because forever you could only hunt till noon or 1 o'clock in Ohio.
Yeah.
They had just changed, and you could only, I don't know what the law is still, if you can only hunt till noon the first week of the season, and then
first week.
Yeah. So, and then the second week you can hunt all day. And I guess I'm not a turkey biologist, but, you know, certainly Kentucky, you can hunt all day for 4 weeks of the season and you get two birds. Now we'll see what populations continue to look like, but there becomes a reality too of the traditional turkey hunt for, you know, what's that look like for a lot of people? A lot of people would sit on a field edge waiting for a bird to come in, because that's the way that you were taught is, you know, the farmer finally turned over his field and they're out there bugging. So you're going to go sit on a field edge. Or, you know, growing up was toting a 10 gauge through the hills in Ohio and, you know, luckily not dying.
You shot a 10 gauge?
Yes.
Oh my God.
With Winchester double S's.
Three and a half.
Fours.
Jeez,
my dad still has the box. He still has a box of Winchester double X's, and it is a New England Firearms single shot 10 gauge. And let me tell you, as a 10 or 11 year old shooting that, you know, trying to kill a bird, and having to put your arm up or your shoulder against a tree to try to steady it, and then shooting it and saying, like, this is how you're supposed to hunt turkeys. Not the greatest foray into it.
That's why
as a youth.
That's why your retina's loose.
That's probably why my retina's loose.
Damn, man.
Gone this year, so you can say you're the only turkey hunter in the U.S. using a 10 gauge in the spring shot.
Man, like I've considered it. Like I've considered, like, I get one bird and then just for old time's sake, taking that out and trying to kill a bird with it. Aaron said that he had a guy contact him for TSS for 10 gauge. It's like, how's, you know, are you trying to stop your heart and dislocate your shoulder at the same time? Like, I can't even think about how big of a pattern that would throw, but two, how bad that would physically hurt.
Yep. I've seen probably three come through the messages on the Saddies page. And every time I just shake my head, like, dude, why don't you just go grab a handful of TSS and throw it in the field? Like, that's basically what you're doing.
I mean, I think he priced it out one time. It's something like almost $30 a shell or something along those lines for the amount of TSS you'd have to put in a 10 gauge. But I mean, going back to what we were talking about, like a traditional turkey hunt, you know, for a lot of people is different everywhere. And I think people, we've had this discussion before, getting outside your comfort zone and trying something different can be the difference between, you know, killing things consistently and, you know, being the guy that says, never saw one this year, never got one. It's like, well, you're never getting one every year. What do you think's the problem is?
Yeah. And I would say part of that's a part of the learning process. Like, it shouldn't be easy, in my opinion, but here in the South, I don't know if y'all kept up with regulations or hunted down here much, but in the past few years, they've made some pretty big regulation changes, which I know they take a survey on and take the public input, but they've reduced days you can hunt. They've reduced bag limits. Alabama has introduced some more intricate regulations specific to WMAs and even times that you can hunt. Because I think obviously they're trying to reduce the amount of birds that are harvested. They're trying to help the turkey population. And I know there's been some data that's come out that said that those changes don't even affect the turkey population. And there might even be some research that suggests that. But I feel like so many people these days, especially in the last few years with reaping becoming popular, it's like everyone thinks they just do whatever you can, crawl up to them with a decoy or use a decoy. And I'm not against decoys, even though I don't use them. I'm not one of those guys that hates on people for it. But you would think if the state wants to reduce the amount of turkeys being taken, just outlaw decoys completely and don't restrict people's time during the spring, and you're going to drastically reduce it. And, you know, my opinion, that's not necessarily educated on it, but they definitely reduced our bag limits and, you know, time in the spring. So kind of an interesting topic in reference to the traditional turkey hunts, but a lot of people are doing it these days.
It's always very interesting, the conversation about why turkeys are declining. I think it's easily answered, but it's not, because there's like so many different arguments. And I think the answer is all the arguments, that there's compounding factors, that like the deck is literally stacked against those things. Because when the turkey population was good, still fluctuated pretty good. And so now, since COVID hit, and then when you talk about like some of these bigger YouTube channels that literally are a driving force, I think the pressure's just become insane. And then technology, it's become quite tough. And then of course, you know, habitat, to me, habitat's number one, just simply because it keeps disappearing no matter what. Like, we keep killing coons and coyotes and, you know, adjusting regs and everything. And then the dude across the street goes and mows his field and sprays it down. And now it's a developed complex, or, you know, so I don't know. It's crazy though.
It's death by a thousand cuts is what it is.
Yeah.
It's lots of different things.
I was thinking, because I had this conversation a few different times, but the question that came to my mind is, what do they have working for them?
Right.
Because the answer seems to be nothing, because even the people that care the most about them, especially these days, I mean, they're just killing the crap out of them, whether it be the people that manage their properties for them and bring their buddies in, or the people that travel and hunt public land. It's become like duck hunting. You know, no one's satisfied with one. You got to bounce to the next state in the same day. And it's kind of, I don't know, kind of counterintuitive a little bit, but it's interesting to see.
I'm with you there. So to me, like, Ohio went to a one bird, and I have a bunch of buddies that are like, oh man, I wonder if they'll bring it back to two. And I'm like, don't bring it back to two. One turkey's
not
fine.
Not anytime soon.
Go hunt Kentucky. In Kentucky, you can go to a one bird limit too. And then you can
stay out of my state.
If you need to hunt that bad, go to a state and kill a turkey and then go to another state. You don't have to kill. I mean, what, Tennessee have a four bird limit, Alabama five? Like, that's psycho.
There's some weird, obscure, I'm almost positive it's with their turkey. Like, there's some weird, obscure rule. Like, where you can kill a turkey, maybe it's deer. Deer, you can kill deer every day in Tennessee or something.
Oh, yeah.
Like that. Tennessee's got, a three-bird limit in the spring and then a four-bird limit in the fall. Kentucky's a two-bird limit in the spring. We're going to a two-bird limit in the fall here soon. And, you know, I think you see the greatest rebound in turkey numbers when you go to a one bird limit, like flat out. Like you can go down to a, you know, cut out in the fall. If you said like you can have, you know, two birds in the fall instead of four in Kentucky, I still don't think it would put a dent, because nobody hunts turkeys in the fall in Kentucky.
Right.
Like you go and you look at the telecheck regulations and compare it to the spring. We're one of the earliest opening states out, like, closest to Ohio in the northern states, and we get pounded, especially on WMAs, to where they put in a rule up here where you can only kill one bird on a WMA. So if you kill a bird at, you know, the one you cross right over the state line, you got to go to another one if you're only hunting public land to get your second bird. You know, private land, you can do whatever the hell you want. I don't know how I feel about that still.
Is that per season or per year?
That's per season.
Okay. So you wouldn't be like left out in the cold if you killed one in one WMA in the spring and then go back in the fall. Okay.
No. This is the only type of animal where you see this garbage with, where you constantly have shifting regulations. You don't see it with rabbits. You don't see it with small game. Yeah. You very rarely see it with deer unless they're managing. There aren't any grouse left.
Right.
I mean, like, they did this crap with grouse in Ohio and in Kentucky, and you see the result of it. Same with quail.
Still have a season on them.
Yeah, still have a season. Why? Still have a season on quail. I mean, because there's somebody who wants to. I'd love to go hunt grouse, but guess what? There aren't any left.
Right.
And, you know, the good old days of turkey hunting, like, I hate to break it to everybody, it's like they're not here anymore. Like, you got to take some level of responsibility and culpability for this kind of stuff in order to make sure that it works. Like, it's eternally frustrating to sit there and see people go out and, you know, bushwhack birds and then say, where's all the turkeys at? It's like, well, like, right. Maybe it's because you killed flipping four of them this spring.
Like, if everybody that wanted to kill more than X amount of birds or something, like, how cool would it be if you got a bunch of people to pull their money together and do kind of like what Kyle does with the Native Habitat Project and just buy 5 acres and literally just cut it, plant native habitat in there and let it grow and burn it every 2 or 3 years or whatever they do, just anything. Give the poor things a place to nest and retreat, something like that.
Because they really safe zones, because obviously public is public, and then as far as private land goes, if someone isn't already hunting it, most private land people don't really care about turkeys like they do, say, deer that are more protected. Yeah. They just let you hunt them, so they don't have a sanctuary.
Mm-hmm. Well, the ridiculous thing about it all is that you look at a place like we hunt in Kentucky every year. Like he's so invested in, I mean, the federal government and the state government has plans where they will pay you money to put in pollinator habitat or to get rid of honeysuckle so you can promote growth or do controlled burns. Like the state will come in and do these things for you if people just like waiting by a phone to come out and do this stuff, and people don't want to do it. And it boggles my mind because it creates an entire ecosystem where it makes your deer hunting better on top of all that.
Right.
Like if you make the property good for turkeys, you're making it good for deer. You're making it good for, I mean, for goodness sake, I heard a quail down there. What was that, last spring? It's the first time I heard a wild quail in probably 10 years. And it's because every one of those farms down there has invested in that idea of, we're going to create habitat for these things and other stuff's going to come. I mean, I don't mean to sound like the freaking Lorax here or anything, but like there comes this reality when like you speak for the trees and it helps out the birds.
Well, you have a really good point, because at the end of the day, when you start taking away a bunch of the different game animals, songbirds and mice and moles and voles and just all of the things that nobody thinks about, and you got the quail, rabbits, rough grouse, etc., that are going by the wayside, well, what's left? The turkeys. Yep. You know, so the and you know, I'm of the mindset that you're pretty much not going to trap out the predators. You're always going to have coyotes and coons and all that. You can have a few less. I think the coyotes are quite the weird conundrum, though. I really don't understand how we got rid of them ever in the first place, because they do the little thing where they sense their populations down, so they just breed more, have more babies. But
I mean, you're never going to get rid of their highest, you know, their largest predator, which is is raptors. Like like that's reality. You got a you have a federally protected animal that its primary dinner is wild turkeys. Like a great horned owl kills more hens in a year than a coyote is ever going to kill. And I'm not saying don't trap, and I'm not saying anything about like nest predation is a real thing. But if you're talking about like how many birds are dying based off that, walk through the woods and see how many like feathers you see hitting on the ground beneath roost trees every once in a while.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you'll hear great horned owls every spring, every fall, and they're not too far away from where those turkeys are roosted.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I agree, man.
I don't know if people just don't like see that, and that's why they don't just associate raptors with, you know, eating turkey or attacking them. But like Chris and I saw it firsthand
on
that farm in Kentucky. It was wild. That hawk flew right over top of us and smacked that hen right in the field. It was crazy.
It was a collision.
Yeah.
He knocked the dust off her ass. There were feathers everywhere. We heard it. And she cussed that hawk all the way back to the ditch too, man. She was yelling and screaming. Ka-ka-ka-ka-ka-ka. I can only imagine there were some F-bombs in there. What do you think about bearded hens, Stu?
Oh, sorry. I thought you were talking to Rick. As far as the regulations with them?
Should or should you not? Do you shoot bearded hens?
Well, I've never even hunted a state where it was legal. It's an interesting conversation, just because obviously you don't want to take out many of your hens because they're the ones that lay the eggs. But then also in some states, you could shoot them in the fall, and it's legal there whether they're bearded or not. Which the argument, it's the same thing with like a doe having a fawn, like whether you should take does in the late season when they have fawns or beforehand. It doesn't matter. It's the exact same thing either way. You know, it's still potentially two deer, just like if you shoot a hen in the fall or a hen with a beard, her eggs are going to either not ever exist or they're going to die if you shoot her in the spring. So personally, I think it would be a little bit weird to shoot a hen just because it's never been legal where I've hunted, but I don't know how much it would affect them if you were to split it, you know, between one gobbler and one hen, like say if you did the limit that way. Like it used to be three gobblers in Georgia, now it's two. I don't know how that would affect the population. You know, I'm not a biologist, but I would advocate for it.
Yeah, you're allowed to kill them here in Ohio, and I think Kentucky too. But we've,
yep.
I'm not sure about Josh. I can't remember, but I know Rick and I have both passed up opportunities on them, and we'll continue to just because it's more eggs that could, you know, hatch. I don't ever. It's also why I won't fall hunt turkeys because generally you're scattering poults and then doing an assembly yelp and, you know, shooting a poult in the face basically. So I mean, I hate it because like when you're met, everybody's done it in the deer stand where they're like and they all just line up single file and run to you and I'm like, good god,
that'd happen this fall.
It'd be wreck city, man. But yeah, just was kind of curious on your thoughts there. So tell us a little bit about your we went on a tangent there. Tell us a little bit about woodsmanship skills and what you think you use in your arsenal to kind of help you gain a lot more success in the turkey woods. Maybe some things a lot of people don't do that you might do.
Okay, well, I would have to think that a little bit. But as far as the woodsmanship, obviously there's different levels of it because I think maybe knowing what to look for when you're scouting, which is kind of basic because if there's turkeys in the area, you're normally going to find out pretty quick, especially if you go there in the morning when they're gobbling. But whenever you're, before you even work a bird, like I mentioned earlier, just knowing how to walk through the woods quiet and, you know, being stealthy. That way, if you are presented an opportunity, you haven't blown it before you can even have the chance of capitalizing on it, whether it be walking around a roadbed and not being careful and blowing out turkeys that are hanging out there, or whether it be once you're already working one, just knowing how to naturally fit into the sequence of events, because you tend to think of it like some rare scenario, but they're doing it every day during the spring. You know, that is what occurs in the woods. It's a gobbler and a hen trying to find a gobbler, and you're trying to get in between those two things, or hopefully find him alone, because that's best case scenario where you don't have other competition. But you have to think that he is used to roosting in close proximity to a hen, the natural sequence of events occurring, whether it be him flying down to his favorite place and her coming to him, or there being a middle point, and you tend to lose patience trying to rush things. So that's one of the main things, is before the hunt even starts, setting yourself up in a situation for it to occur, you know, just being stealthy in the woods, making sure you're not just, you know, going through it like a bull in a china shop. And then once you're in that interaction with the bird, making sure you know when to move your gun barrel when it comes down to that moment, you know, when he's actually in range. Because if you move too soon and you can barely see him, I mean, everyone's tried to shoot at a running turkey once, you know, his neck gets bobbing between trees, and that's usually a losing battle from the beginning, you know, but people tend to empty their guns once that occurs. But that's a big thing for me, is once you're working a bird, just trying to be as natural as possible and as patient as possible. And if you can stay in the game for as long as you can without giving yourself up with him seeing you, then a lot of times you can end up killing the bird. You know, you just have to make him think you're a hen for as long as possible. And woodsmanship is a big part of that, because if you make a setup where he's going to see you as soon as he's in, or before he's in range, then you're out of the game right then and there. So there's a lot of factors that come into it, and it's very situational. But I think having the right setup from the beginning and then knowing to adjust if you need to is a big part of it.
I like it.
Yeah.
Anything to add, gentlemen?
No. Pretty much hit the nail on the head.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I would like to hit on, we talked about this before we started the podcast, and it goes along the lines with, I think it's kind of the main topic we were supposed to have before we got on our tangents. But in terms of like covering ground, Stuart, you talked about not only like boots on the ground, but covering ground with, I believe you said, your bass boat, right? So using some water access. So how often are you utilizing that? How, like, what's your success been like that, like coming at birds or accessing birds from the water?
So in the beginning, it was hunting birds semi-locally that I had seen fishing or just going to a lake that I knew had turkeys on it, whether it was national forest or wildlife management area. And the main thing with that is you're able to hit different areas without ever getting back in your car. So you're just able to drive around. And a lot of those areas are landlocked with private land on the backside, or the access is really far away. And it's also a good starting point, which I know not everyone has a boat, but it's a good starting point if you want to try new areas, is to put the boat in, maybe do some fishing, or if you're just hardcore, you know, wanting to use all your time for turkeys, bounce around and look around until you see sign. Or in certain areas in the southeast, we have Tennessee Valley Water Authority, and you know, they draw the lakes down in the wintertime, so there's, you know, all that exposed clay bank. You can see turkeys on that when you're fishing. The fishermen will tell you that.
Yes, so, you can.
Locating is part of it, but also just putting yourself in the game when trying new areas. I had a hunt last year where I bought my North Carolina license to go try it out, and it was already mid to late season at that point. And I had been covering crazy amounts of ground by foot. And then one morning, I decided to take my boat out there to a lake. And it was the first time I had taken my boat out, even though I'd been trying to cover ground by foot. And I had seen some hens and some sign and things. But the first time I took my boat out, parked it in the middle of the lake, heard a bird gobble, and I was able to go over there and ultimately kill the bird. It was a lot of work once I got the boat parked. But I was able to get my North Carolina bird off my boat after walking all that time, 2 weekends prior, trying to at least find one, and I was never even in the game, which it was late season, but ultimately the boat is what got me to that bird.
I never hear, well, at least I feel like I never hear about people talk about just access on birds. You hear it all the time when it comes to like deer hunting, like how important access is. But like you said earlier, Stuart, like the best bird is to hunt is the bird that has never been pressured, right? And I feel like utilizing that water access, I mean, it's not too many people are doing that. And like, let's say you got a piece of public, whatever, that you can get to from water access, but you can't on the other side because it's private. Let's say that private, it's got a nice field for them to strut, but there's a bunch of pressure on there, right? So those birds are accustomed to that, right? Their survival instincts are going to kick in. So maybe they're holding up, you know, closer on that public near the lake more often. So I feel like utilizing something like that, like unique access to get to those birds, would, in my mind at least, kind of give you an opportunity at a quote-unquote unpressured bird, at least in that what I would call like a safe zone area if they're over there.
Yeah, and I try not to advertise it too much, but I guess I did just talk about it on a podcast. But For whatever reason, one of y'all might know the answer to this, but turkeys also seem to like to roost near water, whether it be a lake or a river. I don't know why, but it's just maybe they feel safe having, you know, water rather than land near them. But
yeah. It's the thermals. They can bed wind to back that way.
Chris and I have had that conversation with us just scouting. Like last year we've had it, and then some of the spring scouting we've done. Finding birds near water, and I think it's a couple different things, right? Because where there's, you know, flowing, where there's water, there's habitat diversity, places where birds can, you know, roost and nest and kind of do everything that they need to do. I feel like it also provides an aspect of safety, so they have a way to escape predators. All they got to do is fly across, whether it be, you know, a large creek, river, or something. They could fly across and easily escape a predator there. So I think it's a few different things, in my opinion.
Yeah. They jump off a ridgetop and they're almost in a treetop somewhere where they can roost just underneath the canopy. And it's been interesting the more I've paid attention the last few years, you know, the finding birds has been a little easier. It's, you know, by no means are we pros at it, but It's a little better.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, you want to go ahead and wrap this up, Rickles?
Yeah. Yeah. I'd be remiss if I didn't say this. If you have the ability to take somebody out this weekend after this, this drops, please do, especially if you're in Kentucky, get a youth out this weekend, and take someone on their first turkey hunt. But, folks, this has been the Mobile Hunter Podcast. We've been your hosts, Rick Cates, Chris Leppert, and Josh Luck. And tonight we were joined by Stuart Keene of the Hunting Grounds. Hope you all had a wonderful night. Talk at you later. Bye.
See you.
See ya.
Awesome.
Thanks for tuning in to this week's podcast. The best way you can support the podcast is by sharing online and with your buddies at Deer Camp. Please follow us on Facebook and Instagram and leave us a 5-star review.